From theheart.org radio, you are listening to Click and Rub with Drs. Eric Topol and Paul Tierstein.
Well, this is Eric Topol with Paul Tierstein in the next edition of Click and Rub, and we have the chance to discuss a very interesting paper that was in the New England Journal, March 11th, 2010, entitled Low Diagnostic Yield of Elective Coronary Angiography. So, Paul, what were your thoughts about this study?
I heard about this at the ACC, and it was quite the buzz at the ACC. A lot of talk about, oh, my God, did you see the paper? Yet another onslaught against PCI and invasive cardiology. You know, and then I read the paper, and I was kind of surprised that everyone was talking about this in a very negative way, because if you read the paper carefully, not that negative. The abstract, I think, is a little misleading, because it doesn't really disclose what's going on in the paper. But most of the people talking about it didn't really read it or get it, because the concept here was that 39% of angiograms were obstructive. You know, the rest of them were so-called normal. I think the way they put it was 39% undergoing diagnostic angiography had significant obstructive disease. They defined that as greater than 70% narrowing of a native coronary or a vein graft, and should be a native coronary, and greater than 50% narrowing of a left main. That sounds pretty bad to you, right?
Well, it says 39% had 20% stenosis, so that a large minority, well over a third of the people, didn't have a finding that would have warranted having the angiogram.
Yeah,
if it was known before, I guess. So, and of course, it was a massive study, right? They had almost 400,000 people from the ACC registry.
That's it. That's where the whole thing falls apart, and people don't get the message, because it was actually more massive than that. It wasn't 400,000. They started with 2 million people. This is just lost on everyone, particularly the lay press. Then they ruled out, they excluded all the patients who had a very high probability of having significant coronary disease. They took out 1.6 million of the 2 million.
Right.
So the 80% of the patients are excluded. Why? Because they've already had PCI, or because they've had bypass surgery, because they've had unstable angina or acute MI, undergoing liver transplant, something like that. They exclude those patients. So now you're down to 20% of the people undergoing angiography, who are the ones undergoing it where you really don't know if they've got significant disease or not. And of those, only a third or 40% had significant disease. So really that means 12% of the entire world of angiography were free of disease. So you had about a 12%, quote, unnecessary procedures, if you choose to look at it that way.
But if you just look at the figure one, before they excluded anybody, right, and they had, as you say, almost 2 million people at the 660 sites, only the rate of significant coronary disease was only 60%. So that truly somewhere north of 30, you have to say, as they concluded, didn't have significant coronary disease, right? No matter where you cut it, at the big denominator, or as you're pointing out, at the skewed sample with all sorts of reasons why they honed it down to 400,000. But no matter where you looked at it, there still were a lot of people that didn't have any coronary disease, right?
I don't actually agree with that. I think that the rate is what I was taught. It makes me really questioning. I was told that, you know, you should have about a 10% false negative rate, or else you're not doing enough angiograms.
Oh, sure. 10% wouldn't be bad, but it looks like it's over 30%.
Yeah, but if you take the whole group, I think it's closer to 10%. Maybe it's 15% if you take the whole group. And they
okay.
said maybe we're not connecting on this statistical analysis here. I don't think anybody's questioning that you should do an angiogram on patients who have unstable angina, abnormal stress tests, chest discomfort, after a PCI or after bypass surgery. Only 60% of them may have a significant blockage, but you still need to get an angiogram on those patients. I think that no one's questioning that. It's the patients that are really uncertain, that have atypical symptoms or have no symptoms but have only an abnormal stress test and haven't been in coronary disease world that I think everyone's questioning.
Okay. So just to get the interpretation right, when they conclude in a large national registry, only 38% of patients without known heart disease who underwent angiography had obstructive coronary disease. So your point about that is that they've really taken a subgroup, and it isn't really 38%. It's somewhere like 12% or something like that?
Yeah, okay. It's a subgroup of a subgroup. It's saying let's take a look at patients who are unlikely to have heart disease and see how many of them are unlikely to have heart disease. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that it gets misinterpreted. particularly by the lay press and people, is saying, like, gee, what are we doing all these angiograms for when part of the patients have actual disease?
I got the impression that there was a pretty substantial number of people who got to the cath lab either because they didn't have any kind of functional test, that the symptoms were justification for the angiogram, or because there's such a high rate of false positive stress testing.
Right. Well, clearly, one of the things I agree with is that we need better stress testing, and that's a good point, because you've been saying this for years. I mean, you wrote about it in the early 90s, and then there's this more recent paper, I think it was in JAMA in 2008, saying that in the Medicare population, something like 44% or so of patients who are undergoing angiography actually had a stress test. And, you know, that comes up at our CAD conference a lot. We keep digging in on it. But what's interesting to me is that in this study, 85% of the patients in this kind of quasi-subgroup where they were four, if they had coronary disease, 85% of them had stress tests, and yet they still found only a third of them had significant disease by their criteria. So isn't that interesting how bad the stress tests are? I mean, you're right. A lot of people go without stress tests, but, you know, the stress test isn't that great. The angiogram seems to be better.
Right. That, I guess, was a segue for the whole CTA era, with then now kind of a pullback on that because of the radiation and the problems with reimbursement.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
There seems to be a swing back to not using CT angiography as a screening tool, in part, knowing
good
that
point.
Stress testing is a problem. Now, I don't know if you saw, but just yesterday, GE announced with CardioDX this study where, you know, you use peripheral white cell expression, the gene expression pattern from circulating white cells can predict, at least to some extent, whether or not a person is likely to have significant coronary disease. And that test of CardioDX is going to be marketed, and GE is behind this now, which is surprising because GE obviously makes cath labs.
I've always thought that if you had a good marker, you'd be good for GE in the cath lab. You'd be able to uncover more disease. But I think there should be better markers, and that's a good example. Of course, you know, we've got to put it through the tests, and so many things have been tried. And I have to ask the question, Eric, what's so bad about a coronary angiogram? I agree a CT angiogram is a great substitute in a lot of patients, and I would like to see it used more. But my mother just recently had a coronary angiogram. It was a negative coronary angiogram. By the way, I asked her if it would be okay if I mentioned that publicly like this. And her response was it would be fine as long as I didn't use her name.
Okay.
But I didn't go to my IRB about it. But, you know, I didn't get a HIPAA release from my IRB. But it wasn't done in my hospital, so she had atypical angina. And her doctor wanted some definitive answers, and she had an angiogram. And her perception of it was so interesting to me. First of all, I had called her on the phone. She had it done on the East Coast, and I was on the West Coast, and it was urgent. And she said, Paul, that's nothing. What you do all day, nothing. She was unimpressed. My whole field. She said, no, that's a simple thing. That's nothing. And then I told her about this discussion we were going to have because I had to ask her permission. She was dumbfounded by it. She couldn't understand why anyone would complain about obtaining an angiogram that was normal. She said, you know, it's a diagnostic test. Aren't a lot of them supposed to be normal? You tell Dr. Topol that I said that a negative angiogram is a positive thing.
Yeah, I like it. Well, that says actually more than most scientific papers, you know. What you're getting at is the peace of mind that it provides, right?
I mean, exactly. I think.
But let me ask you this, though.
By the way, you could take that another step. The peace of mind it provides. And also, in this paper, we don't hear about the patients that had 20, 30% blockages. You don't hear about IVIS and FFR, which is what we incorporate routinely. I think these are wonderful instruments to focus patients on risk factor reduction. You know, you've got to make sure you remove the word normal from your vocabulary when you're talking to the patient. Unless they really have pristine, clean, baby-like coronaries, which most of them don't. You got to say to them, look, you know, you don't need a stent, and that's great, but you really need statins. You really need lifestyle changes. And show them the blockages. Show them the IVIS. It's very dramatic.
I was going to get at that. It's good. So many people in the medical community and, of course, in the patients think if there's no significant stenosis on the angiogram, then that's great, but still just scratching the surface if there's no ultrasound. Obviously, it doesn't have to be a critical stenosis for a patient to still be vulnerable. So how do we assure patients that they're not sitting in a vulnerable state?
So right now, I take care of a lot of patients, and I think that you do the best you can. If the patient is asymptomatic, they have risk factors, you do a stress test. And if the stress test is okay, then I think you let them go. If they want to get a CT angiogram on their own nickel, I'm not really against that as long as they don't do it too often. But if they have symptoms, you know, I think a stress test is in order as well. But if you can't console them with a normal stress test, you're still uncertain about it. I don't think there's anything wrong with doing an angiogram. A CT angiogram, in those circumstances, is not a bad way to start if you really just want to rule it out. Because if it's normal, you can be sure they don't have the disease. But I don't think there's a big deal about doing an angiogram. Now we're doing radially, you know, it's a pretty simple procedure. I realize there's a lot of radiation. I realize it's expensive. But if there was concerns about whether or not I had coronary disease, I'd like to have some catheter.
Okay, now I'm tracking with you, and I'm very impressed about your mother's comfort zone. But now I'm going to move to the point of you do this angiogram, and it was on quasi-questionable atypical symptoms, right? And you find, on the other hand, the difference of what we've been talking about up till now, where all these normals that you potentially could avoid doing, but now you find this ornamental stenosis that is irresistibly stented, maybe even multiple stents.
Well, you've got to be very careful about that.
Okay.
You really do. I mean, that's important. That's a really important caveat you're bringing in. And I always tell these kind of patients, you've got to have something big in a substantial vessel, and we're going to probably do further testing with ultrasound and FFR. Because what you don't want to do is get involved in a stent, a thrombosis, a restenosis, and they didn't need it in the first place. That's hard.
Right.
I agree. I think it's dangerous. If you are responsible when you go in there, I think you can negotiate that path.
So you think you can be in a look but no touch type of mindset? Do you think that average cardiologists could do that and resist temptation?
I think. With all the secondary testing and the FFR is really getting big. FFR is growing.
Maybe that's a good thing. Yeah.
I interact with hardworking cardiologists who are taking care of patients all the time. You know, every day I spend maybe 5, 6, 10 phone calls from docs in the community when I talk about patients that they're having trouble with. And I just think they're trying to do a good thing. I've not said this to you before. I think they're working hard. They're trying to do their best. They don't want to do unnecessary procedures, and they don't want to get sued. And you know that if you're having a quasi-indicated procedure and you have a complication, and everyone knows you can have complications, you know, that's a potential lawsuit. So I think that people do pay attention to this.
Yeah, well, I'm not questioning that, at least not during this segment. I think the whole issue, not about angiography, but overall, the overuse of medical technology in the U.S., of course, has been a subject at center stage these days. You know, the president of the ACC was one of the co-authors, a past president of one of the ACCs was one of the co-authors. This was a mainstream paper. I think what they came out with and what the media came out with is somewhat discrepant with, you know, your interpretation. And I think that's what's great about our ability to vet this and discuss this on Click and Rub. Just, you know, give some different views. What does it all mean at the end of the day? There'll be more studies about angiography, and there's a lot of these being done every day in our country. The question is, should they all be done, I guess?
I think you should keep asking that question. And I'll leave you with my last comment from my mother, if it's okay. Also, in the last couple of years, she had an appendectomy, which also, by the way, was normal. She did not have an inflamed appendix. I asked her, I said, so, Mom, which unnecessary surgery did you like the least, your angiogram or your appendectomy? And she was very clear that she disliked the appendectomy. She said the angiogram was great. She said she loved the angiogram.
I've said for years that I'd rather have an angiogram than, you know, have a root canal. No, appendectomy. My goodness. It's very interesting. It's a very good perspective. There's no question about the number of people who are helped with a normal angiogram. I think that point you're underscoring. And the question is, should it be 10, 20, 30% to make sure it's kind of like appendectomies where you have to do enough of them so you don't miss a hot appendix and potential peritonitis analogy? It's an interesting discussion, and hopefully it'll engender some comments out there so that we'll know some people who are listening. Thanks, Paul. It was really fun to discuss this with you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Click and Rub with Drs. Eric Topol and Paul Tierstein on the Heart.org radio, sharing ideas and opinions with the cardiology community worldwide. Find out more on theheart.org.